Hello and welcome to a special edition of the In the Money Players podcast, recording this on Thursday, April 8th. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you in the Brooklyn Bunker once again and joined by, I'm going to go ahead and just call him a frequent guest. He's been on the airwaves many times. He is the author of at least part of this new series of papers being dropped from the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation. We're going to talk to him all about that. This is a cause that has been in my mind for many years, especially working closely with Mike Maloney on his book, Betting with an Edge, and some of his thoughts in this matter. The title of the new TIF series is Wagering Insecurity, and the man here to talk about it all is Pat Cummings. Pat, how are you today?
Peter, good to be with you again.
Did you write this whole thing? I should have clarified that beforehand. I figured it's so much content that you might have had a little bit of help on the writing side, but you were certainly influential in putting it all together.
Thanks. There's always a little bit of help from a couple key influential consultants that we have, and but the majority of the actual written word did come from me, and there's plenty of it. It's a substantial series that will run basically for the next 7 weeks. So we've got a lot coming.
The idea of wagering insecurity first came to me, as it did to many people. I was pretty new to the game. I'm sure others knew about this before, but for me, it would have been the Fix Six scandal at the 2002 Breeders' Cup that brought these potential wagering issues to light. Obviously, extreme example there of what was going on with Chris Horn and his ability to manipulate bets after they were placed. But I feel like in many ways, the industry has moved on from these concerns. Feels like things were buttoned up just from the title of your paper alone, though, Pat. I'm guessing you think it's not quite as simple as that.
Definitely not, Peter. I think the first point that needs to be laid out pretty clearly is that the overall poor state of wagering system security, so the actual betting systems and technology that are used at present in North American racing, and then the overall integrity measures that surround the sport. Okay, there's two different things there. But the overall poor state of those is not the fault of any one individual, track, corporation, organization, regulator. The fault here is very shared, and it is basically just how the sport has evolved and its systems have evolved. So there is no, whatever blame people want to assign out of this, it is definitely shared. The Fix Six from 2002 is a kind of a flagship or a landmark event that we use to, you know, kind of take off on the modern history of where we stand with wagering security. And the reason is, it was such a shocking incident that it really did shake. It jolted the industry. I remember it at the time, and we've talked to many people who were involved in some of the follow-up. We have gathered transcripts from different industry conferences that are still out there. They're out there for public dissemination. There's a lot of dialogue about it, but I don't think anything has really been pulled together like this, which is to show what everyone was saying at the time and then reflect what happened. They are two very different things.
Walk us through that very quickly. What was said? What was done?
Everything that was said was right, which is this is a massive problem. We need to fix it. This is unacceptable. Commissions were involved. Tracks were involved. Horse players were involved. Everyone said the right thing. Everything that you would expect, that if there was a $3 million fraud perpetrated on, for lack of a better word or term, the biggest day in American racing, and one of the biggest days of racing on the global scene, it was perpetrated. It was caught. Fortunately, because of the results of the races themselves that helped catch it. Otherwise, this could still be going on today. And everyone said, you know, we need to do something about this. We need to get far greater control over this. We need to monitor wagering. We need to look after the tote system. We need to upgrade our technology. We need to find a way to mitigate late odds changes. This is unacceptable. This is bad business. We need to build trust amongst our players and our horse people who are putting horses in these races. We need to make sure that nothing nefarious is going on, that our systems are strong, that there is proper monitoring. We need to put money behind it. And they did. And they spent, in the first 2 years, maybe $3 million on this through efforts that were functioned mostly through the NTRA, but with the support of some commissions and tracks, and a lot of money was put up. There was at least at one point in mid-2005, there was a pledge by the NTRA to spend $5 million, $1 million a year over the next 5 years, to build a central office of wagering security. Right? Think about this in light of where we are today. But things changed, and we outline this in parts 3, 4, and 5 of the series. We in 2005, they said this 5-year strategic plan of the NTRA was to spend $1 million a year for 5 years on this. 18 months after that plan was published, total spending was about $148,000, and then it went away.
Interesting. Interesting.
And so we go into the Arizona Racing Symposium in 2008. There was a really strong panel of three people, and those three people were all talking about the need for monitoring, security, safety, protection of horse players, technological monitoring that would be required, that was desperately needed. And they outlined it all very clearly, the fears that were to be had. All three of those people were basically out of horse racing a year and a half later. Huh. And we talked to two of them for this paper. We went back, found them, stoked them from their horse racing past, and spoke to them on the record for this to get their thoughts. Very interesting to go back and kind of jog their memories and where did things stand then? How did it fail? Why did it fail? And where are we now?
I think the most important thing
has never been put on paper.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by it. I think that's a great approach. But the big thing I want to know is, what actually did change, other than, you know, racing is known for a tendency to solve the last problem sometimes without thinking about the bigger picture of what all the problems are. So I understand that probably the very specific act perpetrated by Chris Harn to, you know, jack the pick six that day, I would imagine that loophole was closed.
Exactly.
But other than that, in the big picture of life, what has changed with these outdated tote systems?
Yeah, so the pick six and all the pick N bets, so 3, 4, 5 or pick 12, whatever you want it to be, however many picks there were of multi-race winner related bets, the function that is used to calculate the combinations and all of that is something called a late scan. It was a late scan. And what a late scan meant is, if you as a customer put in a pick six, and this was the hole that Harn exploited, because of the let's call them the small tubes that are transmitting all of the information, all the betting details on Breeders' Cup Day, big day to begin with, in order to keep all of that flowing and not get everything kind of stuck together, the thought was to hold back the information. So all you transmitted was how much money was being bet into the pool. So if you put together your pick six ticket and it's $288, all you were telling Arlington Park is, I've got a $288 bet here from OTB XYZ, right? And that's what we've got. You didn't send the betting details until after the fourth race.
Right.
And that is what was exploited. Harn knew that, exploited it. And we actually even detail how 2 months prior to the fix six itself, This very scenario was raised by Paul Berube, the head of the TRPB, in a private meeting that he had, and we speak with him about this private meeting that he had, asking what could be done to basically corrupt the results of the pick six, because there had been rumblings that there had been some previous capers that had been pulled that the public didn't know about. So we go into that, and we get that on record, and we detail that. Sure enough, that ends up getting fixed. And so the pick six and all the pick end bets went from being a late scan to an early scan. An early scan means that when you place a pick six or any pick end bet today, after every leg, the host track queries where the bets are coming from, how many people had that horse. So if the five horse wins the first leg, okay, how many of you had the five? And we know that's how you're able to say how many tickets were still alive. Well, the late scan function still does exist for one bet. And Mike Maloney outlines this in his 2016-17 book with you, Pete, Betting with an Edge, that superfecta bets still function in this regard. So when you bet a superfecta today, let's say you've put in $100 ticket. The total cost is $100. The track knows that you've bet $100, but they don't know what combination you've bet. So you're sitting there from your ADW, you've put that $100 in. Okay, fine. After the race, when the result is already known and the order is 11179, the track, the host, sends a message out and says, the order of finish is 11179. How many of all the bet takers out there had 11179? And you've got one that says, hey, we've got $32 on that combination. We've got 16. We've got, 2410 on that combination. And then they get paid out.
That sounds a little too much like the honor system for me.
It still does. And as Mike Maloney says in this series, it is a vulnerability without reasonable oversight, given the technology that is possible but currently not deployed. And it is a problem. And when you look at the results of some races, and I look back to that 29 superfecta in the Kentucky Derby with a 65-1 winner, longest individual priced winner in essentially modern history of the Derby. And the superfecta paid only $51,000. Biggest superfecta pool, biggest field of the year. And you go back a couple of years earlier, in 2010, an 8-1 shot wins the race. It paid $101,000, paid twice as much. There may not be any individual nefarious behavior that has taken place. What there is a lack of transparency and a really significant loss in customer confidence, horse player confidence.
Well, that's a great segue, Pat, to the thing I think most people are waiting for me to ask you about, which is late odds drops. And Mike also writes in Betting with an Edge about the existence. To be honest, I'm not up to date on whether or not this technology is still in place, but the idea of cancel delays where certain bet takers have the ability to make a ticket go away up to whatever, 5 seconds into a race or whatever it happens to be. But an experienced horse player, if you could see the first 5 seconds of a race, the edge that you would have, I mean, it's the same thing as being able to pass post. What about late odds drops? Are they potentially related to that? Could it be something even more nefarious than that? Where do you stand on the security of these pools as far as that they are closed when those gates are open?
So I think you have to acknowledge that, first off, the possibilities are endless. They are endless because no one talks about the protections. No, there is no transparency on what is going on, how the systems evolve, where security stands. And one of the things that struck me in the research for this is that you go back almost 20 years earlier and you see the dialogue around what needed to happen in 2002, 2003. the comments around late odds drops are exactly the same as, you know, 19 years ago as they are today. So to that regard, I don't think that the industry has either gotten a handle on it or certainly not done anything to mitigate the impact of them. There are different things that could be done in this regard to increase the visibility of them. But those have not necessarily been done. I think there's only one track in North America that uses any sort of color-coded system to highlight where prices are moving on the screen for customers. That's Woodbine. But they're doing it not even to an extent that you see in certain places. But I think making late odds changes clearer is a big benefit to the overall public. What we've seen from a lot of racetracks over time, however, has been the opposite, where they simply pull the odds off the screen sooner. They make it harder for you to see late odds.
To see it. Yeah, if you don't see it, it doesn't exist. There's some sort of head in the sand, ostrich head in the sand analogy to be made. And I get it. And I know that it is true that the computer money comes in late. A lot of computer systems very much tilted towards early speed. That's part of it. But I think we've all seen things that cannot explain. I do like that idea of tools. Marshall Graham has talked about some of this on Twitter. Daily Racing Form in their new formulator have an inkling towards this of being able to look at probables to predict what late odds drops will be. But I don't know. It seems to me that alone doesn't explain some of the stuff that we've seen. And it sure feels to me like in 2021, the type of investment that was being discussed in 2002 to have updated technology where this stuff can close without latency, it just doesn't seem, it seems like all it would cost is money. And that in the big picture of life, in a sports betting world of all things, that this kind of technology upgrade is going to be needed for horse racing to continue to thrive in a sports betting world where it's tough enough to see a legitimate 5-2 shot come into 8-5, you know, try selling that to sports, to a new person comes from sports betting, looking at our game. That's tough enough. But then, you know, obviously we see much more extremes than that. To me, it's an investment in technology that the sport really needs to make if it wants to continue to thrive. Am I overstating the case?
No, you're hitting the nail on the head here. And I would suggest that there's a few elements kind of concurrently going on right now, but one of them is that the impact of late odds changes in 2021 is greater than it's ever been before, if for no other reason than the function of legal sports betting now available in, you know, to residents of states where it is legal, representing 44% of the American population. And that's not counting the states surrounding them where it's not legal yet. That price certainty matters. And it matters more than ever because that is where all of the betting is taking place. Customers know if their outcome is successful, here's exactly what they're getting. Meanwhile, horse racing is still studded with discouraging experiences for winning bettors. And it's just basically pick your example. One is worse than another. 23-1, horse breaks out of the gate and is crushed into 11-1, and goes all the way and wins. 5-1 becomes 5-2 in the last flash, and that last flash is happening during the race.
Even if it's totally legit, bet was actually made pre, which again, because of cancel delays and things like that, I can't 100% say with certainty is the case. But even if it is 100% legit, just the optics of it in this modern world are so bad that it needs to change.
The power to impact late odds changes and the experience that we're having right now, where customers don't see it happening, it's happening essentially during the race as the last flash comes and gets merged in, is totally within the power of the racetracks themselves. They could be doing something. They are choosing not to. That is as simple as it gets, Pete. Well, they could be doing something.
What I imagine it comes down to, just putting, using Occam's razor here, obviously they're getting the more money they get based on the more money bet. We're in this world now where nobody's really looking, unfortunately, at the long term of the sport as much as they're looking at their next quarter. And in the short term, this ability potentially to bet very late or have the other advantages that might be afforded to somebody causing these late odds drops, I would think tracks don't want to do anything to discourage the people who are betting the most money. But I think in the big picture of life, long term, it could be cutting off the nose to spite the face.
Absolutely. The industry has given the high volume betting shop players, and we can talk about them a little bit more, but has given them the power to dump massive amounts of bets, money into the pools directly in ways that you or I are unable to do if we tried, right? We have to go through an ADW to do that. But the industry has empowered these players, and it's only a few, to do that. There's a sub-question that comes off this, which is, who's actually betting what? And the answer is, publicly, we don't know. Right? We don't have that information. There is no central repository. The industry does not keep track of it. Horsemen's organizations who are involved in contract negotiations don't have that. And it should actually be pretty important to understand, what is the composition of our handle today? You know, who makes up the $10.9 billion that was bet in 2020? And what type of customers are they? How many new customers do we really have? We know, for example, that last year, roughly $6 billion roughly was bet through the major ADWs. Another $500 million or so was bet through some smaller ADWs hubbed out of North Dakota. And that's just on thoroughbred racing. But we also know that the tracks were pretty much closed for in-person betting. The OTBs pretty much closed most of the year. We have a pretty good estimate of what Canadian customers put through the windows. We know what we have some good estimates of what a group like NairaBets puts in, even though there isn't a public reporting on that. That's not $10.9 billion, Pete. Right. It doesn't add up. So the question is, what's the difference? And it looks more and more like you get close to around $4 billion of money that is coming in from these super high volume entities that are putting a tremendous amount of money in. And they're given tools. They're given advantages over ordinary customers. That's troubling. And it's long-term, not a real sustainable business.
Who's regulating them?
The industry. The industry's created the rules for these groups. They are called secondary paramutual organizations, SPMOs. There are rules written about them. There are some checks that have to be done. But it is an industry-funded group. That is through a consortium of racetracks that is checking the box for them and giving them these opportunities to participate. So the industry has control over this. They just haven't chosen to exercise it in a way that will yield improvements for the greatest number of stakeholders. They're doing it for the greatest number of single individuals who are contributing tremendous amounts, disproportionate amounts to total parimutuel wagering.
There's a big problem here in what you're describing to me, just logically, Pat, because, you know, the industry obviously benefiting so directly from this handle, isn't that a complete conflict of interest for them to try to regulate these entities who are already being permitted to play by their own rules? I mean, where does it When you're giving certain customers advantages that most customers don't have, where do you draw the line and where does that stop? And I mean, from my understanding, this just isn't how oversight is supposed to work.
Well, it's a great question. I think the answer or at least the line that one could use here is that self-regulation works until it doesn't. And you know, there is no company or very few companies or corporations around the world who will often voluntarily raise their hand and say, more regulation, bring it on, here we go. Send it our way. Yep, it's going to cost us money, but it needs to happen for the good of the corporation, the good of the industry, the good of the value chain, whatever. It doesn't often happen much. And our regulatory bodies, the individual state commissions, have they've been a little absent on the topic of wagering. They're typically very involved in testing, right? The greatest number of PhDs and medical doctors, the greatest education credentials in our sport typically come on the veterinary and the equine pharmacological side. There's plenty of really intelligent people on the wagering side. They just don't often have a seat at the regulatory table. And, you know, it should be no wonder that we have, for a very long time, had incredibly detailed information on drug withdrawals and what are the different classifications and of drugs and picograms and nanograms and ridiculously small amounts of this or that. And so that's why everyone can say, horse racing is actually a very regulated sport. It is highly controlled, and it has a lot of experts on those matters. But as there's a quote that came up in our research, it was from about 2005, I think, that called parimutuel wagering a $16 billion unregulated bank. And what would the government do if it knew that this was a $16 billion unregulated bank? And the parallel was actually from a terrorism concern, right? From a financial crimes and money laundering side and what the risks were to national security. And it's a good point, right? I'm not downplaying that, but it is worthy of the chuckle you had, Pete.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, where else in the world is there that much unregulated money? And you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to think of a lot of ways that could redound to ill effect.
And that's one of the things that comes out in this paper, that there are other places in the world which are monitoring betting, which are staying attentive to the possible actions of nefarious individuals or groups. There are other groups who are doing far more in this space than we are. And I think one of the great hopeful bents that comes out of this series is that if we want to improve, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just have to start adopting some best practices that are already in place in some other leading global jurisdictions. And we talk about them quite a bit in the back half of the series. Australia, Great Britain, Hong Kong offer some tremendous examples. We also get into the interconnectedness of doping and wagering. And in so much of the dialogue, we tend to hear of doping only in the sense that someone was trying to take an edge to win for prize money purposes. But examples from the rest of the world suggest that the opposite is also very much in line too, that there are people doping to lose. And then exact a wagering benefit separate to that. It has happened in America before. The incident of Masochistic in 2014 is, sure, is very reflective of that.
The sponges those years ago at Churchill, yeah.
And it's worked in both ways. And if you are only looking at people who are doping and to have a high win percentage, you're kind of missing the mark. And you can't always look at the parimutuel pools to see what's going on. You have to look at the entirety of wagering. If there's worldwide wagering on your races, you need worldwide observation, worldwide regulation. You need to be looking at everything. And as we alluded to in the summary that we released this week, and we'll get into in far greater detail, there is robust betting that is outside of the current view of even the TRPB, which supposedly is doing some monitoring of American racing. That's a group that's a consortium of racetracks funds. But there's a heck of a lot of fixed odds betting, over $1 billion a year by our reports, fixed odds through European bookmakers. There's more on the exchanges. And then there's the gray markets, a gray market might not be a term a lot of people are familiar with, but gray markets are these kind of loosely regulated entities. They may be there may be some gambling commission in the Caribbean or Central America that okays these entities. The Philippines is another.
Offshore. You'll hear the term offshore a lot, right? That's what we're talking about.
Yes. And they may be, they're very loosely watching these entities. But, you know, as we reveal in kind of parts 9 and 10 of this series, there is significant money that is going through these exchanges and these platforms. Americans are betting on them. Americans are being marketed to wager on them. They have tremendously good search engine optimization practices. 180W actually references those in one of the papers or one of the parts of the series and how dangerous it is. And that coups essentially could be going on. But we don't, and our regulators certainly don't have any eyes on this. Our stewards don't have any eyes on this. But the rest of the world is doing this far better, and we reveal some of those practices, what they're doing. And actually, they've revealed them themselves, right? They're very open about what is going on. And so we pull all that together here. We're not suggesting that this is an impossible task. It is possible. We're not reinventing the wheel. Change, improvement is within the realm of the possible. We just have to start trying. That is the reason to be hopeful.
I mean, I like that optimism. I want to bring up the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act. I think when most people hear about HISA, they think of the integrity as being the integrity of the racing itself in the way you were describing before. But, you know, let's obviously HISA, very controversial, becomes the law of the land without a whole lot of details being known about it. But is there a weird way in which that potential crisis can be turned into an opportunity by hopefully having issues like wagering insecurity become part of the mandate that HISA eventually ends up dealing with? Is that a realistic goal, or is that just me pumping blue sky all over the place?
We think it is. It is fundamental to our recommendations. We believe that there is enough vague language in the bill that will enable this. And as some of the experts that we quote throughout the series will indicate, global sports and racing integrity experts, it has to happen. It should be a basic requirement. You can't merely have doping control and not monitor wagering concurrently. The two go hand in hand. For as much as people have heard about the anti-doping program, the medication control, the racetrack safety programs that are part of HISA, and what we have just ludicrously boiled down to no Lasix, which is just ridiculous, right?
That's a whole other conversation. We won't go there now, but I agree with you.
Yeah, it is such a red herring to the overall
That's picture. A good way of putting it.
We firmly believe that HISA offers a tremendous opportunity to uplift these standards. And right after in the bill where they establish these anti-doping and medication control program and the racetrack safety program, which have gotten most of the press, there is a line straight up that says that this Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority shall exercise independent and exclusive national authority over the safety, welfare, and integrity of covered horses, which is basically all active horses in training, covered persons, owners, trainers, breeders, jockeys, all of their assistants, veterinarians, and associated personnel, and covered horse races. That, to me, is the side door into all of this, Pete. Mm-hmm. The definition of a covered horse race in the bill is very simply a race that has interstate wagering, is subject to the provisions of the Interstate Horse Racing Act of 1978, and offers ADW account betting. Wagering is the vehicle that allowed a kind of a federal bill. They took the powers of the Interstate Horse Racing Act and said, if this is wagering on these horses and these races, that is federal oversight. Essentially, it is interstate commerce. That is how we are going to say this mandates federal oversight. And we're latching on to that here and saying, yes, doping control is very important. Racetrack safety, of course, incredibly important. But you cannot ignore the wagering relationship here. That wagering, monitoring and oversight goes hand in hand with doping control.
We're going to play a little game here at the end to help button things up. I'm going to name the game and I'm going to go first. But we each have a magic wand and we get to wave it and do one thing we think will address the concerns we've been talking about today. For me, it would be to create an immediate investment in a fully modern, state-of-the-art tote system that eliminated latency and provided a lot more transparency to assist with the kind of regulation you've been talking about today. You can just agree with that one, I suppose. But Pat, what would you do with your magic wand?
Yeah, I will say to that point, Pete, it's worth noting that the current protocols that are used, and it gets a little in the weeds, so I'm not going to go too in-depth on that. Some tote individuals I've spoken to, executives, long-time people in the tote business, have indicated that there is a general recognition that what we have simply cannot go on, that these entities, the tracks themselves, are not willing to continue, or at least a group of them are not willing to continue investing in the really insufficient protocols that exist in tote betting. It does not enable transaction-level monitoring. And despite the fact that we tried to do this and tried to get it together years and years ago, it just hasn't been sufficient and it's still the same thing that's in place now. So I agree with you. I think there is a realistic plan or a conversation dialogue that is beginning about what is needed going forward, but it's definitely not what we have now. That's not much reassurance to anyone who's betting today, though. I will take something a little more manual. It's a recommendation that we have adjusted a little bit from a previous publication from TIF, but I think it would go a long way to building confidence, restoring confidence, and allowing that to grow within horse players. And that is to really increase the role of race day stewards in the oversight of what goes on during the race. It is, you know, that role cannot simply be about judging interference or counting whip strikes, crop strikes, or doling out fines. It has to be more. It has to be bigger. We need to know in today's day and age when a horse returns with substantial blood in its trachea. We need to know that. Every other modern developed racing jurisdiction on the planet is reporting it. We need to know that too. We need to have stewards who question jockeys as to why they did certain things in races and put it on the record. If that means replacing chart callers with stewards, guess what? We would be joining the rest of the world where the stewards essentially are the chart callers. That happens. It's going to take a lot of training. It's going to take starting small and growing. But you need to have the people who are policing the sport, police the whole realm of the race. When you have a race that on paper looks like six horses are going to vie for the lead, only one goes forward, five take a hold, and that one horse goes on and just runs away from all of them. You have to ask the other five jockeys, what were your instructions pre-race? Bring the trainers in, ask them what were the instructions pre-race. Are there any differences between those? You need to build confidence in the people who are having a bet that what they see on paper is very likely going to reflect the experience. And if it doesn't, develop an explanation for this. To an American horse player, that might sound like such a pie-in-the-sky possibility, and it seems impossible to enact. The rest of the world does it every day. So there are examples to follow. There is, you know, this is not an impossibility. It is going to take a long time, and we are fully cognizant of the fact that incremental progress is still progress. And we need to just push everyone forward in that direction, get moving there. Let us build a culture of transparency, openness, information sharing, Let's build in more where the regulatory veterinary side is more open and transparent to the public, and join the rest of the developed racing world in presenting a product that really meets the modern needs of the customers who are wagering on it.
I got a couple more for you before I get out of here. Is it overstating it? And I want to go back to where we started, the Fix Six scandal and the aftermath of that back in the early aughts. Too harsh to say that ultimately the reforms of the wagering integrity, easy for me to say, in the USA after the Fix Six scandal were somewhat akin to putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. Is that too harsh?
No, they put the Band-Aid on the pick and bets, right? They eliminated the loophole that generally seems to have been exploited in the Breeders' Cup Fix Six. They got that right, as you had said earlier. Is it perfect? I don't think so. Is it greatly improved? And is that Band-Aid stopping the bleeding on that? Yes, I believe so. It's just that we have a tree here. It's an old 100-plus-year-old tree. And there are so many branches. There are different problems on all of them. We still have leaves that are active and alive on some of them. But there's a lot of dead branches. We need to trim those and build new ones. Inspire life to save the tree.
You prune so that you grow stronger.
Exactly. We're going to try and borrow the pruning techniques of other landscapers, of other tree doctors. And, we could take the horticulture. We could take that example as far as you want it, but that is what needs to happen. It can happen. But putting the Band-Aid on the Fix Six worked in some regard.
It just felt to me like that was the time to maybe get like a seismic change and a giant investment. And it sounds like there were people around that time, many of whom you spoke with for this paper, who were thinking about the big picture and fixing the tote system. My last question for you is, give me at least one takeaway from talking to the folks who believed in tote reform circa 2003, who were out of the biz by 2005. Like, what did you learn talking to them?
When you bring everyone together in the business, it's very easy to stand up on a podium and say, yes, we need to do this, and then actually do it. And one of those people, Paul Bollinger, who was a vice president of the Association of Racing Commissioners International, he's former head of the North Dakota Racing Commission. He says, a lot of people said yes, yes, yes. And when it came down to executing or being asked to do something, they just ended up saying no, no, no.
Coming down to money.
Yeah, money and ability. Don't forget, we've had tremendous industry consolidation here, right? The racetracks, a good number of tracks own two of the main tote companies. They own many of the ADWs. They own many of the service providers. And at least in one case, they at least own a high-volume betting shop. This corporate consolidation has been good for profit-making. It has not been good for evolving the business. It's been good for just rent taking, essentially, continually over the years. That needs to change. It needs to evolve. I think fixed odds betting is not some devil. It's not a savior, right? It's not a savior, but it is not on its own merit the devil. It offers us an opportunity to evolve our business, and a little bit of competition nipping at the heels of tote betting, we think would be good for parimutuel wagering overall.
I think of it more as co-opetition personally, Pat.
Absolutely. Great. Yeah.
I think that you'll, from what I understand, they're going to do this correctly, where it's not going to be England, where people are getting cut off at the drop of a hat for winning. Customers are going to be allowed to win a certain amount on individual accounts per day, something on the order of $2,000. Now, that's great, and it'll actually turn this market to where the littler player will actually have an advantage and be able to not only compete, but have an edge over the bigger player who isn't going to be able to get that same price at those low amounts. But lo and behold, if you can create somebody who's going to be a horse player, they're going to be participating in the parimutuel pools as well eventually, with a better foundation of understanding how to play the game from the pricing knowledge and handicapping knowledge they get from fixed odds. I almost see them, for lack of a better term, graduating into the parimutuel pools, so then there's no limit to the amount that they can win and they can participate in the biggest scores this game has to offer that makes parimutuel wagering on horse racing still something that I obviously see as viable and great. And I mean, you know, I've been a little cynical during our time today, Pat, and I just want to clarify for any like industry people listening, it's because I love the game and you love the game and we want to see it continue to thrive and get better. We're not trying to pick on anybody. We're just trying to look at this from a little bit higher of a view, as in terms of, you know, not what's going to help racing next quarter, but what's going to help racing in the next quarter of a century and beyond. And that's where this frustration comes from.
Yeah, agree entirely. On the fixed odds point, absolutely. To the greater point that you mentioned, yes. We don't have enough people in North American racing leadership who have a really good understanding of different ways to run this business, right? There is not a lot of international experience. There are not a lot of individuals who have seen up close how it's working other places and are empowered in some way, shape, or form to do it here. That is and has been a very clear hole. But it presents such a great opportunity. But that frustration, and Pete, you and I have both had plenty of overseas experience to see this happen. It doesn't mean that what they do is perfect. Is it better than what we are doing here? Yeah, it is. And it frustrates you when you're an American and you don't see America competing at the level that it should be. And that really is what really, I think, tugs at our heart. That we could be doing far better at home than the rest of the world. They're running away from us.
I feel like we have the chance to really come up with a model that combines the best elements from a bunch of different places and puts us in a sweet spot if we can get our act together as far as a few of these key areas go. And wagering insecurity is, for me, near the very top of that list. That is the name of the new series of papers from the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation. Pat, where can folks find these papers to learn more?
RacingThinkTank.com. You can sign up for the email distribution list. We'll send out a note maybe once or twice a week around these papers, and then sporadically. You can find it on Twitter at Racing Ideas. A lot of different opportunities there. I'll leave you with this line, Pete. Racing has, in America in particular, has always been looking after how we can create new customers. It will be and continue to grow increasingly difficult to create new customers if your existing ones are so frustrated with the state of your business at present. How will you be able to get new people involved in the sport if your long existing customers look at you and say, man, what are we doing? This is a mess. We need to fix this. You have to fix the current problems for your current customers before you can gain new ones. So I look at this as just, this is behaving as sustainably as we can if some of the recommendations in wagering insecurity end up getting adopted in some way, shape, or form. This will be a path to us getting new customers in the future.
I believe it's honestly one and the same. Yeah. By fixing it for your core customer today, you're going to make it more appealing. This is a time like no other for gambling in history in the United States. We have a culture that's changing. I got an email from MLB the other day. MLB! Pete Rose, the Black Sox, MLB, telling me all the games I should be betting. Like, this has gone from a fringe activity to the absolute mainstream. And that gives us such a great opportunity, because I know so many people listening believe that our gambling game is a lot better than simply you know, betting 11 to win 10 all the time. Like, this is, we have an opportunity to feature ourselves to best effect. But if we just keep thinking about the next quarter and not the big picture of life, I think we're going to be wasting that opportunity. But Pat, that's why I appreciate so much the work that you do over at the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, trying to offer that. And we know there are people in this industry who are right there with us in terms of understanding the changes that need to take place to get things moving in the right direction and secure our place in the sporting fabric of the United States.
Totally agree, Pete. And the paper will be out Tuesdays and Thursdays, or the series, different parts, Tuesday and Thursday for the next 6 weeks. And they'll all be stored at racingthinktank.com for those who miss it on release day. So there's plenty of good reading ahead.
And let people know where they can find you personally on Twitter.
Yeah, Pat Cummings, TIF. Feel free to reach out. If you have a question, too, there's a link in all these papers where you can send us a comment or question. We're happy to take them. Any information that people want to share, we certainly will treat it appropriately with near journalistic standards of, we're not journalists, we're advocates for improving this business. But plenty of people have provided us some great information that helps inform some of our positions.
For the TLDR crowd, we gave you this podcast. That's one thing. But I also did want to point out that each of the papers will have a summary portion as well, won't they?
Yeah, Pete, you know, there will be a little summary in the emails that we send out of some of the topics that are discussed. But this is a long narrative. And trust me, none of this is timely. Right, you don't have to read it because there's some news event from yesterday that's going to be ignored tomorrow. This is something I think that can easily be revisited over time. We've broken up the series on purpose to present it in at least some somewhat consumable chunks, which is unlike anything we've done before, really. Right, so they're probably I'd say they're good 10-minute reads. Each of the ones that'll be released, and there's some really great nuggets in all of them.
And as the story continues to develop, you know, we'll obviously give you an open door to come back here and chat with me, because as you can tell from the passion in my voice as we talk about this stuff, it means a lot to me, and I want to see racing make the most of what I see as a fantastic opportunity in this time we're living in. We will leave it there, Pat. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate having you on the air. And that's it. I don't have to thank anybody else. I will thank everybody out there for listening and encourage what Pat said. If you want to keep this conversation going on Twitter about any of these matters or reach out to me via inthemoneypodcast.com, please do that. But this show has been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Coatney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.